This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to the Lit Lit Show on Thursday, the 18th of April. On tonight's show, I'll be speaking to Ruud Lullier, and that's the height of my Flemish for tonight, because Ruud will be coming to us all the way from Antwerp in Belgium, and we'll be talking about teacher optimism and how that helps raise achievement. Oh, that's sure to get a response.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live. Tune in live at ttradio.org, or to join in the conversation, download the Podbean app and search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio. Tune in, talk it out with Teachers Talk Radio.
I've always considered myself to be a caring head teacher who acts sensitively to support staff mental health. But what I found increasingly difficult was managing the negative impact on staff mental health when resolving issues related to their employment or daily work. Heartfelt Leadership has been developed by TeachWell Toolkit as a handbook to support head teachers to overcome the challenges of school improvement while supporting staff well-being. We know that difficult conversations can quickly turn into conflict if procedures are not fully transparent, understood, and followed. Our handbook takes you through step-by-step processes while maintaining mutual respect, avoiding conflict, and finding solutions.
At Bloomsbury Education, we're passionate about supporting teachers with high-quality professional development books from leading experts. Whether you're navigating your first crucial years as an early career teacher, or a more experienced teacher looking to refresh your practice or take a step up into leadership, our award-winning books are here to help. We publish practical books to support teaching across primary and secondary, from the very best in research-led practice to trusted advice on inclusivity, behaviour and curriculum design. Visit the Bloomsbury Education website at bloomsbury.com/education to find out more, and use code BLOOMTTR24 to save 20% on all education titles. Bloomsbury Education, books for every step of your teaching journey.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Lit Lit Show. And my guest this evening, Ruud Lullier. Hello, Ruud, are you there?
Yeah, Paul, I'm here. Hello.
Hello, that's great. Oh, it sounds really clear. And you're over in Belgium, in Antwerp.
Yeah, that's
is that
true.
Right? Yeah, great. So, what was your day like? What was your weather like today? Make us all jealous.
Well, I can make you jealous, actually, but it is the first day in a long time that we had some sun, so we're really happy with that.
Oh, it's always nice to get some spring sunshine, isn't it?
It's true. It is.
It really is. Yeah. Yeah, it's great. Ruud, you've done a lot of work on teacher optimism and, you know, the impact that that has on young people in a school. And that's going to be the main focus of our chat this evening. But just tell our listeners, how did you get to the point where you're at now in your career?
Well, stumbled into education by accident, actually. And I started teaching around 18 years ago in secondary schools, and I teached mostly behavioral sciences. And one of the subjects of behavioral sciences is one of the important subjects there is the educational inequalities, and it was something that was a close subject to me. I really felt it was an important thing, especially because in Belgium, I know, and Belgium is not the only country in the world with that experience, has a large gap in performance. And it's really dependent on some background characteristics of the students, background characteristics that shouldn't play a part in education.
And so you're very passionate about that, yes?
Yeah, Yeah, it's something that I see in my surroundings, living in Antwerp, which is really a big and diverse city. And yeah, it was something that has always been close to my heart to be able to do something about it.
Mm, yeah, right. That's great. So you talk a lot then about teacher academic optimism. Now, those words for us, you know, there's something resonant about that. Teachers kind of like to think they do have a lot of optimism for everybody and for every child in their class. Is that what you were finding?
Actually, more or less, we do find a lot of optimism, and it's really nice when we visit schools to see the passion teachers have to educate their students, to really reach their students, and to get together with them into this educational path. So, actually, we do. It's not always in the same efficient way, but it's beautiful to see what teachers, the difference teachers try to make. That is really an important thing and a beautiful thing to see. But it's there is a difference between the intention and the actual outcome, as teachers are, as everyone, human beings. And human beings are flawless. They do make mistakes, or they do. It's not about, maybe not really about making mistakes, but they do have prejudices. And that, yeah, those things can make it really difficult to reach the goal of educating, of giving every child equal opportunities in education, for example. It's one of the things that make it difficult.
Yeah. Okay, so all teachers, certainly the vast majority of teachers, their intentions are good, but then you're saying things happen, things get in the way that prevent that from happening. Is that more or less what you're saying?
Yeah, it is. And that's interesting.
One of the things, I just say, Ruth, one of the things I used to say when I was teaching, you know, football is easy. It's a simple game. You know, if you take Manchester United, all they have to do is run down the pitch and score a goal. That's all they need to do. And it's a bit like teaching, you know, all you have to do is get children to learn things, be able to do things, understand, have good attitudes and so on. But we often forget, you know, there's a Liverpool that are trying to stop Manchester United from running down the pitch and scoring the goal. And I think there's something like that in teaching. You know, we all know more or less what we should be doing, how we should be doing it. But there are lots of obstacles and difficulties in our way to just simply doing that on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, that's true. That's a nice metaphor you have over there. And it's true. It's most of you don't start teaching with the idea that you wanna get after those children. No, you wanna help them. You wanna educate them. You wanna teach them. But then in reality, it's often not that simple, and things get in the way. But the good thing is that solutions are around the corner, and there are things to do. There are things that can be more or less easily changed to make it, to get the core of the teaching business back to the fore, and to really make a difference in these students' lives.
So what were some of the things you found out then about teacher optimism?
Well, maybe the first thing about it is that I explain it first, what it is.
Of course, exactly.
So it's we call it teacher academic optimism. It's not something I invented. It's something that arose from a decade-long search for school variables with an impact on student performance, even after controlling for these background variables like SES or migration background or previous
SES?
Variables. as yes, the socioeconomic status of the child.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's, yeah, we know that these background characteristics have a big influence on the outcome of students. We see that if we can actually predict for most students how they will end their schooling career by looking at these background characteristics. And that means that they really have a big influence, often bigger than what a school can do or the differences that teachers can make. And so we have this big research where other researchers were trying to find these school variables with an impact on performance, even after controlling for those variables. So it means that they were looking for school variables with a bigger impact than these background characteristics. And that is when they, after they, it was really decades of research, and then like more or less 20 years ago, they had this kind of summary where three important variables were found. And these three variables seem to be linking together, and that is what they called teacher academic optimism. And these three variables are the academic emphasis of a teacher, which means the focus on learning, the focus that the teacher puts on learning. Is the bar, do they have a do they raise the bar high? Do they have high and positive expectations for all of their students? It's also about trusting these students and the parents of the these students, trusting. It's about the willingness to be vulnerable as a teacher, in the confidence that these children and their parents will respond positively, because it's important to be learning. It's important to be able to make mistakes, to show your vulnerability. And the teacher is the first to take that role on them, to show that it's possible to do so. Yeah. And then the third is about teacher efficacy. It's about really believing that what you do will make a difference, that that you can reach your goals with the students in front of you, that you that you are a good teacher. And these three things seem to be interrelated, so they influence each other, and there is something, they are, it's like a triad between these three things, and that's why these researchers called it academic optimism. We have it on the teacher level, what I just explained, and then we also have it on the school level, which is a shared culture within the team.
So let me see if I've got this clearly then. So the first component was the academic emphasis of the teacher. And that's really, we might talk a lot about teacher expectations, holding high expectations here. And, your school might hold high expectations as well. The third one was... The teacher's really belief in himself or herself that what they do can make a difference. Is that right?
Yeah, that's true.
And the second one, I got a little bit confused with the second factor. What was that? I know you mentioned vulnerability and so on.
Yeah, it's called trust, but to have this trust in students and parents, the aspect of vulnerability is really important. It comes together. Trust comes together with this this vulnerability to as a teacher, it's important to have that to be a role model in showing that. Mistakes can be made and no one will be judged for making mistakes. It's, if you're in a learning process, it's necessary to make mistakes. If you can learn from them. There is a space and a time and the trust that you will learn from them. And it's also about, how you present yourself to your students and their parents. Do you start from the idea that they are trustworthy in having this relationship? Do you trust them to be vulnerable, to be to expose yourself, but also to have the same goal in front of you? It's how you how you talk about the parents of your students, how you talk about your students behind their back.
That's fascinating. That's very, very interesting. And maybe before we kind of look at that in a little bit more detailed route, could we maybe just go back then in order and just, the first component you said maybe was academic emphasis of the teacher, and we talked about expectations. But I think, did you do some work with, we might call them vocational classes here, where, you know, they're very practical, the academic isn't the main thrust. How does that happen, you know, with groups like that? Because we all have groups where, you know, they're more practical, they're more vocational classes.
Yeah, I'm really happy you posed that question, because I always thought that academic in English meant more than just really cognitive learning, but I know we have the same here in Belgium, that it's understood like more to pursue an academic career or an academic education. But the important thing is that the focus is on learning. Actually, it's called academic emphasis, but it's broader than that. It's learning, it's any kind of learning. It's also vocational learning, more practical learning, but it's also technical learning or more artistic learning. It's not only academic learning, it's more actually about learning in total. So really putting the emphasis on learning. So this can happen in either one of the classes you have in front of you, even if it doesn't matter what kind of learning it is having high expectations, even when it's about having high expectations that you know how to get your car in the right order, or I don't know any words on how to really explain it good, or how to make the electricity work. Yes. Also there you can have high expectations, and also there it's really important to express those high expectations to the students, because when we have high expectations, we have this confidence in these students that they can reach them. We actually say at the same time, I believe you can do this. If we stop having high expectations, we treat those children differently, and it starts already with really small things. For example, if a student asks you a question, and when you have high expectations of that student, you will it's likely that you will respond with posing another question to make them think for themselves, to try to make them find a solution themselves, and so you teach them how to be independent and really good learners, self-regulated learners. But if you have less higher expectations or if you have low expectations, then you probably, if a student asks you a question, you would probably just give the answer. And it's not that you don't help that student. You answer his question, so you're not a bad teacher or anything, but there is a difference in the learning process you engage that student in, or you don't engage that student in.
Yeah. As I hear you, I'm hearing, you know, the quality of the relationship between the teacher and the learner is very significant. Mm-hmm. And it's very much about promoting passion, interest, inquisitiveness, and really just generating that kind of, you know, depth of want of knowledge and understanding, regardless of, it could be, it's an old fashioned term, we don't use it, but it could be woodwork, for example, where you're learning to build a table, and something like that.
Yeah. It is, and I know from experience, I know it's, there are easier groups of students and more difficult groups of students to engage in that learning process. But I also know from experience, because I have taught these more vocational classes, for example, and that if you treat them They already have low expectations from themselves. I don't know if that's the case in your educational context, but I know in Belgium that the vocational trajectory is seen as the least valuable one, or the yes. It's as the last,
well, less favored in certain ways.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And those children know that is the case. Yeah. And so they already have less self-esteem. They already feel, I had these students really saying to me, please don't treat us as we can't learn. Mm-hmm. It's not because we are vocational students that we don't want to learn. Mm-hmm. And if you can go past that that lack of self-esteem and by having these high expectations, you will give them mm-hmm. their self-esteem back. And so it's really more difficult than in a straight A academic class. I do realize that, but it is possible in those other classes too. And it's even what our research shows, it's even much more important in those classes.
I would agree with you. Yes, definitely. Yeah. Yeah. We would talk a lot here in Northern Ireland. We would talk an awful lot about the self-fulfilling prophecy. I'm seeing quite a link in that. Have you heard of the self-fulfilling prophecy?
Yeah, you're right. You're definitely right. That is what happens. If you have high expectations of students, then they will, they will have high expectations of themselves eventually.
Yes.
If you have low expectations, then that will happen the same thing. Even if you're really convinced that a student, isn't able to follow or to meet those expectations, even then it's really important to keep on having them, because these are children in front of you, and children are really flexible learners and really having a lot of potential.
Often, you know, my experience very often is it's only the teacher who believes in them. Their families, their mm-hmm. communities, and outside of school, no one believes in them. But they can have, some success. They can enjoy good relationships, high expectations in schools with teachers who view them that way and work with them, as you say, in developing passion and an interest in their subjects. Yeah,
it's really important. And you have these beautiful stories about these students who are in a later life with having that one important teacher who made a difference. Being that teacher is of course, I hope the dream of every teacher, the goal of every teacher.
It's very gratifying when you you meet those students years on and they remember you fondly, and they can remember very specific things. And it's amazing,
That's
just
true.
the sense of the impact that you've had. I suppose that leads us into the third component in teacher efficacy, but maybe we'll come to that. So the second component, and I have to say I'm fascinated by this. So this is about trust, really. Mm-hmm. Tell us what that second component's about.
Yeah, it's really about creating this effective relationship with your students, and if possible with the parents. I know that certainly in secondary education that is difficult because you don't have that much contact with the parents. It's more easy in primary education, mm-hmm. but even then, also in certain groups, it's seen as more difficult. But it's really important to create those partnerships where you can, you're together the educators of these children, and but also towards the children themselves, to have those feelings of trust, to know that there is willingness to cooperate, that they have the good intentions, that you are on the same side, mm-hmm. And then about what I said before, you dare to be vulnerable, and mm-hmm. because. Yeah, I can't stress that enough, that it's really important in the process of learning. We all learn from the mistakes we make, but only if we're able to make mistakes, we can learn from them. Otherwise, we just thug them away, and we act as if they don't exist, mm-hmm. and then we can't learn from them. Mm-hmm. So it's really, learning is about making mistakes and trying again, and trying until you don't make the mistake anymore. And that's why it's really important, this vulnerability, to show to students that it's okay to be vulnerable and to not have the answer all the time, but just to try and to try again. Mm-hmm. And that's the important thing. But that's also if you see the triad, and you have like it's the affective component, and I don't know how it's with you, but in Belgium we have this big debate going on between what is the most important. Is it having high expectations and raising the bar and really going for results and performance, or is it about the well-being of the children, and do we have to make sure that children feel good? And I always think it's not about the one or the other, it's about both, to be able to have a good performance. Students have to feel good, and they have to feel trusted, and they have to feel worthy of trust. But at the same time, they have to also feel worthy of having put the effort in to have these high expectations. So it's not one or the other. It's both, and they're both mm-hmm. Equally important. And also if. It's really important to keep the interplay between these elements mm-hmm. inside, because they influence each other. And if you, for example, if you stress the high expectations and having successful performances, if you stress that in such a way that the trust is jeopardized. Mm-hmm. Then it won't work anymore. So it's about balance between these different elements, and about emphasizing all of them in supporting each other, and then it will even rise, even more.
It will, yeah. I can see that link very clearly. You know, that vulnerability that teachers need to have, which can be difficult for them at times. Mm-hmm. You know, they feel they wear a professional mantle, and they don't want to let that mantle or mask slide.
Yeah.
But, you know, we used to fret a lot over attendance, and we used to do some kind of analysis and surveys on attendance, and very quickly patterns would jump out at us. So, for example, you might find that chronic poor attenders would come in on Tuesdays and Thursdays.
Uh-huh.
And when you looked at that, you found, look at the teachers that they have on a Tuesday and a Thursday.
Yeah.
And then you maybe look at the dynamic or the relationship, just as you're describing, the academic expectations of that teacher, the trust that that teacher has, the rapport, the vulnerability. Is that teacher a role model? And you could see, you know, different things were happening in the dynamic between that teacher and those students, you know?
Yeah, it can make such a big difference. If you have that kind of relationship with your students, that kind of relationship of trust, of feeling believed in as a student, then you wanna keep that kind of relationship. you want to make that teacher proud. You want to show them it's right that you trust me. You're right to have this faith in me. and you see a big change in how children react.
Yes, I think there is. Yeah, students can have that kind of that inner glow, as you say. They want to glow for that teacher.
Yeah.
And they want to do justice and do pride and so on.
Yeah.
For that teacher, yeah. I think the other thing that strikes me as you're talking there, Ruth, is I'm just remembering back, you know, that when we teach, and it doesn't matter, English, woodwork, science, you know, sociology, history, whatever, we do an awful lot more than teach the subject. You know, there's an awful lot gets transmitted in one way or another in that room. And I often think, particularly I think as students get older, you know, and they're into that 14, 16, 18 range, one of the things they're looking at as a teacher is how to be a person.
Yeah.
What kind? Because I want to pick up from you. I want to model myself on you. I want to be able to take characteristics, qualities, and strengths that you have, and I want to incorporate them into myself. I know that's an oversimplistic model, but, you know, they're watching. Pupils are watching us very closely. Sometimes we think they're not, of course. But they actually, you know, they actually are, and they're wanting. They're thirsty for knowledge. But it might not be what we're doing on the blackboard, so to speak.
Yeah. No, that's true. And yeah, it's really, they will only want to learn from you if you have that kind, if there is this trust relationship, if they have this, that if there is really respect between the student and the teacher in both ways.
Yeah.
And that's where the trust component is really important for.
Yes, yeah. You mentioned parents in that component. Let's talk a little bit about that before we move on to the third component. How can parents play a role?
It's really important that it starts with teacher trusting the parents that they have the same goal, that both of them want to have their children well educated. And we, in our research, we see a bit of a lack of trust in parents.
Well, and when I was going to say to you, yes, yeah. That would be quite frequent sometimes, yeah?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. When we talk to teachers, they feel like when they, for example, have an argument with a student, that instead that a parent would back the teacher up, that they will support the student, and that they have an angry parent in front of them. Or that parents aren't interested anymore, and that they just want to, they just expect the school to take care of their children, but they don't want to do anything. Research shows that it's not true at all, that most parents, almost every parent, of course, has the best interest in their child, and they really want their child to be well educated, and they really want to be part of their school life too. But for example, what we see in Belgium is when parents from with a migration background, they often lack the confidence to talk to teachers. They feel like they're less worthy of them, maybe because they don't speak the language that good, or because they feel it's a societal thing that that they feel that they're not respected as they would like to be. And it's not definitely the teacher's fault, it's more a broad societal thing, but it has as a consequence that these parents, I have some colleagues who do research to minority schooling, so schools who outside of the regular school, so weekend schooling, who take care of minorities for learning the language, the culture, or even helping with homework. And those parents turn to those schools for their questions, because there they can speak to people with similar backgrounds. And there we see that it's really important for schools, for the regular schools, to reach out to those parents, to create circumstances in which they can be part of the school without feeling, or without, maybe it's better to say, most of the times when parents are invited to school for the first time, it's or to discuss their report, the report cards of their children, mm-hmm. the grades of their children, or when there are difficulties, when there are behavioral yes. problems or yes. things like that. Mm-hmm. And we see some successes in schools where they start the school year with inviting the parents and having these conversations with the parents, and where they really ask the parents, okay, tell me all I need to know about your child. Tell me how do you think I can be a good teacher for your child? What do I need to know about him? And of course, you can't do that with every student you have, but mm-hmm. we have like these mentors. So every student has a mentor. One of their teachers is their mentor.
Right.
And so these mentors can play, can have these roles to reach out to the parents, and not on a moment when it's there are high stakes because of the grades or because of mm-hmm. some difficulties, but just from the beginning, just to get to know each other. And
yeah.
it takes
yeah.
time, but it's so rewarding because it mm-hmm. When teachers are involved, parents are involved, and there is a close contact between teachers and parents, then a lot of things can be, how do you say that?
Resolved.
Will not happen.
Prevented, yes.
Prevented, that yeah. was the word I was yeah. looking for, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Gosh, that's fascinating. Yes, it's always interesting to watch how other places kind of organize and structure and manage. Mm-hmm. Do you know, as you were talking there, Ruth, I don't know if you've seen a film called The Teacher's Lounge. Do you know it?
No, I don't know it, but I do have a clear images with the Teacher's Lounge.
It's a German film. Gosh, it might be worthwhile if you looked it up. I think you'd be fascinated by it. I'll put a link in the show notes for anybody. I don't think it's an easy watch for a teacher. I think it's quite a difficult and uncomfortable watch for a teacher, but in a funny way I don't think the film's actually about teaching, even though it's entirely set in a school. Yeah. But anyway, look, we'll leave that for there. We'll put something in the show notes about it. So
just a little thing to add, that what is yes. really important about the teacher lounge is what is the talk about parents, about students? Are
yes,
teachers
yes,
complaining about the parents? Are they being negative about it? Because these things have a really big influence on how we treat students, how we think of them, or how we speak to them about their parental support, or what we expect. And so it's not innocent the way we speak about the way teachers speak about parents in the teacher's lounge.
Yes, it's not without value. It's value laden, yeah. and it then becomes, or can become, part of our attitudes and our behaviors towards those children. Yes, that's fascinating. Yeah. We did have Rachel Lofthouse on this show, and we talked about staff rooms, and we talked about some of the difficult conversations and how they create a certain cynicism and so on.
It's true.
You know, you can have other people there who can create, you know, a very positive, bright, dynamic,
yeah,
dynamic view of whatever it is.
But What we saw in our research that the principal has a really important role. It's really important that these discourses, that the way, if you hear people speak like that, it's difficult for another teacher to react upon its their colleagues. It's it would be beautiful if we could, but it's a lot to ask from some people. But it's really important that a principal sets out what is okay and what is not okay, and that it's really clearly articulated. We see that can, in the light of academic optimism, that can really make a difference.
I think that's very true. Yes. Yeah. There is that sense of guidance from the leader who sets the standard, the tone. And the staff do largely, more or less, they do comply with it. Yeah. I know we're talking, you know, again, it's a little bit like Manchester United. You know, we're talking the ideal game. Just get the ball, put it in the goal. But, you know,
I'm
sure it's the same in Belgium. Look, teaching days are tough.
Yeah, it's true.
Teachers walk in. And look, 9 o'clock on a Monday morning, you know, you can have a behavioral issue, an incident, you can have foul language, you could be called names, all sorts of things can happen. So, you know, I mean, how difficult, I'm kind of jumping on a little bit, but how difficult is this to do? It'll come very naturally, I think, to some teachers.
Mm-hmm.
As a group of teachers, how difficult is this to do?
It depends a lot on the combination of people you've got in the team. If you have a small team, it will be easier to change. If you have a strong leader and some strong teachers who are already quite academic optimism, it will be easier. If you have a big team and if you have a lot of difficulties and there are big differences between student populations in schools, and it can be hard. I will not ignore the fact that teaching is really it's a difficult game to play. I started teaching when I just became a mother. So my son was like 4 months old when I started teaching, and I always thought I was so tired because I was a young mother. But it's only when I stopped teaching that I realized it was the job that was tiring and not my being a mother of young children. So it really, I know it is, but the good thing about this academic optimism thing is that it's really a deal changer. We have done comparative research in schools with high levels of academic optimism and in schools with low levels of academic optimism. And these teachers, they talk so differently about their students, about their job, about their days. And these schools were comparable population-wise in speaking of student population, they had the same difficult student populations, but the level of academic optimism was really different. And it was so different to hear those teachers speak. So it's really worth investing in these levels of academic optimism, because it will make the job less tiring. It will make a big... Yeah, it is a game changer. It can be a game changer.
That's what I wanted to come on to. So the third component really was efficacy, teacher efficacy, actually believing that you can be effective and efficient in doing this. Okay, so let's move on then. So what can teacher academic optimism, what can it actually change? You say it's a game changer. So what does... you know, the school day to day, what does it look like when the teachers hold this optimism?
Well, it's you have this team that isn't it isn't cynical. It isn't it believes in itself. It believes that what they do is really good. And if you believe in what you do, then you get a lot of more energy in doing it. It's this teacher academic optimism or the school academic optimism is a framework. It's only a framework to help principals and teachers guide their actions to if they feel like it's not going as I want it to go, it's not going as well, performance is declining, or we have more and more behavioral incidents, or it's really teachers have dropout, there is a high teacher dropout, and if you want to change the things, then it's really valuable framework to consider, because it hands some really practical guides for things you can change within the school itself. You don't have to wait for a bigger policy to change. It's, for example, if we go to these efficacy beliefs, it's really important to express what is going well for a principal, to focus on the things that are going well, even in schools where it feels like everything is going downhill. There will be some things going in at least better than the other things, and to emphasize on that, to celebrate every tiny success that you see, to really. We have the tendency as people to focus more on what's going bad than what's of going course. Good, yeah. And to change that attitude, to change the to learn from each other. To also, this vulnerability will affect the way in which teachers will act towards each other. For example, if it doesn't work that well in a classroom with some certain students, then you should be able to speak up and to ask another teacher for help, and to say, how do you do that with those students? Can you help me with this? But also there needs to be this atmosphere in which those things are possible, that you can be vulnerable, you can admit what doesn't go well, what mistakes you make. And that will help feelings of efficacy too.
Yeah, yeah. So you're really talking there, I think, about changing the culture of the school. Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I remember an old teacher worked with me, and he used to talk about that. He used to say, when the bell goes, no teacher walks out of their room, goes to the colleagues and says, oh my goodness, I've just taught a brilliant lesson.
No.
So, teachers don't do that, even though we all go to a staff room.
Yeah, it's true, and it's a shame.
And we won't really do the opposite. But we won't do the opposite. We won't go to the staff room and we won't say, I've just taught the worst maths lesson ever. We won't do that either.
No, we should do both. Both are so important.
We should. We should do both. But what we will do is we will go and say, that class were awful.
Yeah, and those students, and it's always we blame the students. And, That's also a big difference we saw between these academic optimistic schools and academic pessimistic schools. Mm-hmm. Is we asked them how they attributed their successes and their failures, and in the academic optimistic schools, they never refer to the students and the characteristics of the students. They were always looking to how the things they could change, their controllables. It's really important to focus on those things you can control. You can't control.
Do you think that's easy? Do you think, you know, bringing a culture of a sense, a feel, a culture of optimism, do you think that's easy to do in a school, Ruud?
I don't think it can be done overnight, but our research do show some really clear opportunities in which it can, for example, the influence of what we have called performance management for academic optimism. It's a leadership style in which
that's catchy.
Yeah, it is, and it's really about emphasizing the importance of these elements of trust, of academic emphasis, of efficacy. It's really, really articulating these the things that are important to reach them. And also, if you see, for example, as a teacher, talking, like I said before, talking bad about parents, or if you see that a teacher lowers the bar because he feels like the students don't cooperate in a good way, to not ignore that and to really talk about those things and to speak to teachers and to stress the importance of those things, and the effect of having a teacher like that is remarkable. It really, it's always difficult because I talk about the effect. It's always difficult to know what was first. Do we have, because we these are correlational studies and we have no experiments to do. So it's also possible that these academic optimistic schools have other principles. But then again, with everything we've studied so far, and with not only what we have done, but also other researchers in other educational contexts, we do see the importance of the leader. And I know the leader gets a lot of responsibilities, but this is not about, these are not big differences. It's about the way you talk, the way, what you emphasize, what the remarks you make, and that is the first thing to start with.
I think that's absolutely right. I do think so. And I think you notice that when you have a change of principle. So, you know, if you've somebody who was, you know, that had a long career, it was sore, it was tiring. And look, teachers are human. They can get hurt, they can feel wounded and so on, and their energy can flag. And then, you know, maybe if you get a fresh teacher in who has that sense of optimism and views teachers and children differently, or at least, you know, views them with a sense of hope and optimism, you can see a change very, very quickly, I think. I do think it can happen. I think it can happen when you get you know, even classroom teachers in who maybe have a different view, and they maybe decide to then take a football or a netball team, and they kind of come at the school from a different angle, can kind of change, you know, the ethos and so on. Rud, we're just going to take a little short break now, and we'll be back after these messages.
I've always considered myself to be a caring head teacher who acts sensitively to support staff mental health. But what I found increasingly difficult was managing the negative impact on staff mental health when resolving issues related to their employment or daily work. Heartfelt Leadership has been developed by TeachWell Toolkit as a handbook to support head teachers to overcome the challenges of school improvement while supporting staff well-being. We know that difficult conversations can quickly turn into conflict if procedures are not fully transparent, understood, and followed. Our handbook takes you through step-by-step processes while maintaining mutual respect, avoiding conflict, and finding solutions.
At Bloomsbury Education, we're passionate about supporting teachers with high-quality professional development books from leading experts. Whether you're navigating your first crucial years as an early career teacher, or a more experienced teacher looking to refresh your practice or take a step up into leadership, our award-winning books are here to help. We publish practical books to support teaching across primary and secondary, from the very best in research-led practice to trusted advice on inclusivity, behaviour and curriculum design. Visit the Bloomsbury Education website at bloomsbury.com/education to find out more and use code BLOOMTTR24 to save 20% on all education titles. Bloomsbury Education, books for every step of your teaching journey.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News.
The BBC reported on a long-term study by the Institute of Fiscal Studies, which found children living near Sure Start centres did better at GCSE. The research says these living near a centre performed up to 3 grades better than those living further away. Sure Start began in 1998 to support new parents, especially in disadvantaged areas, but due to austerity, many have since closed. The Department for Education said its Family Hub scheme had a number of advantages over the Sure Start model. The IFS study used postcodes from when children were age 5 to determine proximity to centres and looked at the GCSE results of those children 11 years later. It found what it describes as big improvements in performance in those living near a centre, especially those from low-income backgrounds. Former Prime Minister Gordon Brown, Labour Chancellor at the time the initiative was launched, said the UK now needs a new Sure Start, and described the results as what most parents already know, that a supportive environment in early years was life-transforming. Among all children in the study, those who live near a Sure Start centre performed better than those who lived far away, but the trend was most pronounced amongst those eligible for free school meals and those from minority ethnic backgrounds. According to The Guardian, schools in England could lose up to £1 billion in funding by 2030, with exceptional falls in pupil numbers prompting closures. Mergers and school closures are already happening in parts of London, where pupil numbers have been falling for some time. According to the think tank Education Policy Institute, the North East is projected to see the greatest decline in primary pupil numbers, down by 13% by 2028 to 29. At secondary school level, Yorkshire and Humber, the North East and London are projected to have the largest falls in pupil numbers, although other areas, including the West Midlands and the South East, have rising numbers. Pupil numbers had grown because of a fertility surge in the 2000s, but as that cohort has moved through, numbers are now falling. Even with increases in per pupil funding, the EPI predicts schools will find it hard to balance budgets as fewer pupils do not lead to reduced costs. The decline is due mainly to a falling birth rate and changing migration patterns. Full details of the EPI projections can be found on the Guardian website. Schools Week reports on the decision by Ofsted to appoint a former chief inspector, Dame Christine Gilbert, to lead the independent inquiry into its response to the death of Ruth Perry. Dame Christine served as the HMCI from 2006 to 2011 and now chairs the Education Endowment Foundation. The Learning Review follows a coroner's ruling in December that an Ofsted inspection contributed to the death of Mrs. Perry, then head teacher of Caversham Primary School. The review will consider actions Ofsted took in response to hearing about the death of Ruth Perry. Dame Christine will have access to relevant records, Ofsted staff and the opportunity to meet with Ruth Perry's family as part of the review. The review will not examine the November 2022 inspection of Caversham Primary. Teaching unions have expressed concern about the appointment of Gilbert, saying it was critical that the review was robust, independent and impartial, and that some would, rightly, question the notion of a former HMCI reviewing the work of Ofsted. A report will be completed after the review and recommendations will focus on future actions. Schools Week also reports on a plan for the Department for Education to work with the Scout Association to provide 40,000 explorers, those aged 14 to 18, with the skills and knowledge they need to consider a career in teaching. The DfE will work with the Scouts to create age-appropriate activities that inspire young people to consider a career in teaching, linking to relevant badges and awards. It did, however, clarify that there are currently no plans for a teaching badge. The policy is part of the DfE's Get Into Teaching plan, which aims to elevate the status of the profession and target new audiences who have not yet considered teaching as a career. The scheme will launch in September, and it is hoped that it will reach 40,000 young people. The Scouts will create support and guidance material for those running the programme. The initial one-year contract is worth £43,000, but can be extended subject to budget availability. Finally, a teenager who campaigned for skateboarding to be included in school qualifications is proud to see it added to the list of approved GCSE sports in Wales. According to the report on the BBC News website, Qualifications Wales has added 13 new sports to the approved list for GCSE PE. Other newly allowed sports include BMX, shooting, kickboxing and wakeboarding. The new Made for Wales GCSE in Physical Education and Health will be available for first teaching from September 2026. The change makes Wales the second UK nation to include skateboarding behind Northern Ireland. This has been your Teachers Talk Radio News with Joe Fox.
Welcome back, everybody. And I see Northern Ireland got a nice mention in the news there. You're listening to the Lit Lit Show on Thursday, the 18th of April. And I'm talking to Ruth Lullier, who's from, I'm sure I fell through that again, but who's from Antwerp in Belgium. And I'm ashamed to say I know very little about Antwerp.
It's a beautiful city, though.
It's a beautiful city, is it?
It is, yes.
Yeah. Diamonds. I want to say diamonds. That's all I know.
Yeah, that's true. I don't have any of them, but...
you don't have any. Oh, dear. Right. So, this evening, we're talking about teacher academic optimism. So, Ruth, what's the future for teacher and I should say school academic optimism? What's the future hold?
Well, I really hope this concept gets into most schools. That's my hope for the future and my hope for the students. We are investigating some more the antecedents for academic optimism so we can really help schools and teachers to... to raise the levels of academic optimism in the most practical ways. That is our goal, mm-hmm. And so that is what I and my colleagues will be doing in the next years.
Excellent, yeah, super duper. Yeah. And we're nearly out of time, so it's traditional in the show that I ask a question along the lines of, let's say you had a magic wand and only one spell that you could cast. What spell would you cast to make the lot of teachers much better?
That's a good question. Well, I think... Oh, I want to do so much. But if I had one spell, I think I would give every teacher the opportunity to be able to inspire their students and to be inspired by their students. Did I just put two spells into one?
No, we'll let you away with that.
it's the inspiration part. I think it's really important. I dream of every teacher to be this this storyteller in whatever preferred subject or practical area, so students really get inspired, are inspired, can inspire themselves, like you said before, that they be inspired to grow into the person they want to be, and that those teachers can guide them into that. And I think if there is inspiration, a lot of beautiful things will happen. A lot of learning will happen, and inspiration happens in how do you say that in the context of of trust, of respect, of having expectations, of believing in that what you do is really good. If you really believe in it, you can talk about that with inspiration. So I think inspiration is a nice a way to conclude academic optimism with.
Excellent. Yeah. Okay, we're right out of time. Ruth, it's been fantastic spending time with you. Thank you so much.
I had a lovely
for your expertise too. And your insights.
Thank you so much for the really nice talk.
Super duper. Thank you very much. And let's talk again in the near future.
Okay, let's do that. Have a nice evening, Paul.
You too.
Bye.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.